This is the Job Hunter podcast, the part of the internet that attempts to explore some of the UK's most interesting jobs. I'm your host, Tim French, and if you're new around here, consider me your tour guide around this virtual careers fair as we visit another exciting part of Britain's workspace. Now, I'm sure many of you listening may have had aspirations to be driving around in my next guest's vehicle, visiting far-flung parts of the globe, all the while gaining important skills from one of the most recognisable institutions anywhere in the world. So strap yourselves in and get ready as we launch headfirst into this week's episode. Welcome back to the Job Hunter podcast. On today's episode, we'll be standing to attention, marching in perfectly straight lines, and exploring parts unknown with my next guest. We welcome Richard Cutland to the show, 30-year veteran of the British Army and now head of Military Relations Europe for online game developer and publisher Wargaming.net. Firstly, thank you so much, Richard, for agreeing to come on the show. I've been really looking forward to this one. Why don't you start us off? At the very beginning, where did this desire to join the military come from?
Well, right at the beginning. Firstly, Tim, thanks very much for inviting me. Lovely introduction, by the way. It takes me back a bit. The desire, it's a question you get asked all the time. I suppose as a young man, I think like many young men, I was totally fascinated by the military. I mean, my go-to toy from as long as back as I can remember was always model soldiers, sort of action men, that sort of thing. As I got older, I was obsessed with, I mean, I'm much older than you, Tim, so you probably won't remember them, the Commando magazines and little booklets and that sort of thing. So I always had this love of military in my veins, because a lot of people assume, of course, that it's your, you know, the family thing, that the family, but my family certainly were. My dad did national service, and it was probably my grandfather, actually, who sort of ignited my desire to sort of know more about the military. He was actually a veteran of World War II and was a prisoner of war for many years in Africa. So he never used to talk much about it. And it always, I think the fact that he didn't talk about it probably intrigued me more than the fact that if he did talk about it, that makes some sort of bizarre sense. So it's probably my grandfather who interested me. And yeah, it was just something I always wanted to do. I looked at, you know, we're talking, you know, I'm an old man. So we're talking back in the days where apprenticeships were the big thing and everybody was saying, you must get an apprenticeship, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I spoke to my parents. I just said, look, I've got to give this a go, because I do feel like, I think like a lot of things in life, if you don't give it a go, you'll always have the what ifs. And I have to say that, you know, when I applied for the armed forces, it was never, I think like a lot of young men at that time, it's let's do it for 3 or 4 years, see what we feel about it, and then move on to a proper job, for want of a better word. So, yeah, that's really where it sort of all stemmed from to start with.
Were your parents supportive in that vein? You know, were they fully on board with you? Because I imagine they're probably going, oh, no, poor little Richie's going to get blown up somewhere eventually or something. Was that difficult at that time? Because I imagine times have changed now, but how did you bridge their fears and worries about you going off to join the army?
Yeah, like any parent, I'm funny enough, I'm in the position now, my son's just applied for the Royal Marines and he's in basic training at the moment. So yeah, I'm now completely the opposite side of all of that as well. They were incredibly supportive. I think like a lot of parents, of course, they're worried about the job. At that particular time, it was sort of Northern Ireland, I suppose, was the big, you know, it was just before the Falklands War and everything else as well. So, yeah, of course they were concerned. But I have to say, I mean, you know, recollection, I don't ever remember them saying, we don't want you to do it or ever, you know, putting me off at all. They were, you know, very supportive. And obviously when I joined the army, I joined at a very young age. They had to sign to say that I could actually apply for it. So, yeah.
So what is that entry process? You mentioned doing an apprenticeship. But is that the natural route in for most people, at least when you started that to nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, things have changed, obviously, from the recruitment process over the years. I mean, actually, my very last job before I left the army was in army recruitment, of all things. So I was quite conversant in it. But at that time, there was a thing called the Junior Leaders Regiment of the Royal Armoured Corps. Now, I always had a hankering for wanting to get into tanks and armoured warfare. I just loved that sort of the military, that side of these big lumbering beasts. At that stage in my life, we were actually living in a little village as well called Bureges, which is down in Dorset. And just up the road from there was the Tank Museum. So we obviously spent a lot of time at Tank Museum, and I think that was it. So I made up my mind early on that I wanted to go in the Royal Tank Regiment and serve on tanks. And the Junior Leaders Regiment of the Royal Armoured Corps was how you did describe it. It was probably, I don't know, a bit like a military school, I suppose, for a boarding school. So I actually joined that when I wasn't even 16. I was 15 years and 8 months old when my father dropped me outside. As far as the initial process, very much like I think people think, you've got to do written assessments, you've got tests, you have to have, it depends what part of the army, of course, you're going for. If you're going engineering, you have to have your maths and English, et cetera, et cetera. So again, it's completely, the criteria is dependent on the particular job and the role you want to take in the armed forces. But yeah, that was it for me. And then came 18 months of sheer hell, really.
So what is basic training like? What, for those that have Shocking. No understanding of what the military is like, and you describe it as 18 months of hell, but what does that entail?
I think what you can, as a civilian, of course, if you imagine basic training, I think everybody thinks it's horrible. And yes, of course, you're right. You're totally spot on. I think most people could probably guess. It's Junior Leaders Regiment was slightly different because, as I said before, it was almost like a military boarding school. So it was tempered with education. We did, you know, a lot of educational stuff while we were there. The idea of Junior Leaders was to promote the leaders of the future, if that makes sense. So the junior NCOs, you know, the warrant officers, sergeants, and that sort of thing of the future. But of course, there was your normal basic training. So getting up incredibly early, having very little sleep, getting shouted at constantly, lots and lots of fitness. And of course, unlike my son, who prepared himself dramatically, I went there with, you know, I loved football and playing, but I was so young that I just went there really being incredibly naive, not knowing what to expect. But I suppose when I look back on all of that time, what it does do is, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing or wasn't a bad thing to going at that stage in my life because, to be frank, I didn't know anything else. I'd come straight from school. I worked part-time as an ice cream salesman for a while in Bournemouth, but that was about it. That was my experience of the workplace. So I had nothing to judge it against. It for me was normal to be shouted at from the minute I got out of bed. It was very organized, which I quite like in my life. I like to know what I'm doing and what time I'm doing it. And that sort of order of life, that's probably followed me through on life, actually. And it was fascinating, of course. I mean, and you meet such, I think fundamentally the whole of the British Army, the people you meet, the friends you make are, you know, everybody makes friends in the workplace, of course. But these are friends which, let's face it, when, you know, the worst case scenario, you'll go to war together and you'll be fighting together. So you trust each other implicitly. And it was just, you know, on top of all the the rubbish that comes with it, it was actually a great deal of fun. A lot of adventure training while we were there. So, you know, I had my introduction to skiing, which became a passion of my life. It was the first time I had ever gone skiing. Lots of adventure training, such as, you know, I remember I learned to sail a yacht whilst I was in basic training. I did rock climbing for the first time, abseiling. So for any young man who enjoyed the outdoor life, it was great. If you can put up with being shouted at, drill, learning all the basics of life. I mean, to the extent that you actually get taught how to shave, because of course, at that age, a lot of us are just developing, you know, bum fluff. There's not a lot else. So you actually get a formal lesson on how to shave properly, how to wash yourself, all the other stuff like ironing, making a bed, which of course I'd never done at that stage in my life on my own before, washing your own clothes. So it's all very much, but I think of course it puts you in good stead for the rest of your life. And like I said earlier on, nobody, I don't think, really goes into the army expecting it to last for as long as it did for me.
Well, sadly, some of us are still learning to grow bum fluff at age 26.
I didn't like to say anything.
So, yes, I might need those lessons. But I think you make a really good point about adventurous training being a big benefit, I suppose. And the stuff that is outside of the actual job is, you know, very, very good, isn't it? It was definitely one of the draws when I applied to be a pilot in the RAF before I went to university. Sadly failed the aptitudes, but the adventurous training side was a big draw because I'm a big skier as well. I did that all through university and that the idea of being able to compete at a high level and doing kind of high level, you know, competition, but under the banner of the armed forces is a real benefit and a real draw to people. There's a payoff between, you know, serving for your country and whatever. So what other kind of stuff can you get up to? What do you get as a benefit out of, you know, signing up essentially?
Well, and also, of course, it was a regular career. I mean, at that time, the workplace in particular was a harsh place. There was a lot of unemployment at the time. It wasn't easy to get jobs. And it does give you absolute, I mean, above all else, security that you'll never find. I think I struggle to think of another job that would give you security like the armed forces. You know, you have an injury whilst you're in the armed forces, and they will look after you. You will still be on full pay. You break a leg whilst you're in training or, you know, serving actually in the army. You know, you're off work for however long it takes until you're better again. They will look after you. The salary, of course, is not the greatest, never has been, and I don't think it probably ever will be. But once you obviously get promotion up through the ranks, get different skills that pay you slightly more, the pay does come up. Accommodation, I mean, when you're in, you know, a single man living in a barrack block, you actually, eventually, when you go to a regiment, you'll end up getting your own room. You're not paying anything. Food is always there. So from an absolute 100% job security perspective, it is fantastic. And obviously, later in life, if you decide to make it a career, stay on, you know, you meet somebody, get married, have children, you even then get army accommodation in a house of your own, which you're paying an absolute pittance for, compared to that on Civvy Street. But funnily enough, I was talking to some veterans the other day, and although that's a massive draw for the army, the problem, of course, is when you come to the end of all of that, and you're very much like, I actually don't know anything. You know, I've hit this age, and I've no idea what, you know, council tax is. I've no idea about getting a mortgage. I'm very, very unprepared on that. And I always think, I mean, for my career, I was extremely lucky because my last few years, I was actually in recruiting based in London. And it was that stage, and for a good three, almost 4 years, I was basically a civilian wearing a uniform going to work in an office. And that gave me a really good idea then of the transition from military life back to civilian life.
Well, I'll definitely be picking your brains a bit later on, a bit more about that and how we can give some advice to some of our, you know, ex-service men and women who've done so much for the country and now looking to assimilate back into civvy life. But let's just go back then. So you've finished this basic training aspect. Where do you go from there? What's the next stage?
So for me, obviously, it was tank. So this particular part of the army I was in was the Royal Tank Regiment. So obviously, it was all about learning tanks. And I'll always remember vividly the first time chieftain in those days, which sounds incredibly odd now, but it was the chieftain main battle tank. You get introduced to that and you learn a trade on that particular vehicle. So my first ever trade was that of a gunner. So I was a gunner on a chieftain tank. So obviously you get taught all about the mechanics of gunnery, you know, how to lay on, how to do fire engagement orders, react to it, how to load the main armament, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what you learn during that training package. So like everybody in the army, basic training really covers you as a soldier. What everybody perhaps think is like an infantry, so somebody on the ground. So you do all the basics of weapons handling drills, you know, nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, all that stuff. And then you go on to specialise in your particular trade, which for me was that of a chieftain gunner. And then I passed off, once I left Junior Leaders Regiment, I actually went to join my unit, which at the time was the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, which again, showing my age, ceased to exist a number of years ago. And they were based in Germany, in Paderborn. At that particular time, obviously, we're talking, you know, sort of towards the end of the Cold War, it was everybody armoured wise was based in Germany, ready to face the perceived Soviet threat. And that's when I went to join my unit there. And, you know, the story carries on from there.
Is it true that every tank has a, like, on tap cup of tea machine?
You know, I knew you were going to say this because everybody it's true. Every British tank does, yes. It's called a BV, a boiling vessel. And it's basically boils up water. But not only that, you can also put rations in there. So like compo, so it will heat up your rations for you. So absolute lifesaver when you're in the middle of a desert or something. And
I was going to say, there's nothing more British than a
nice
tea making
tea.
Machine. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's it. Must be a perk if you're a big tea drinker. You must be all addicts or connoisseurs on which is the best tea by the time.
You see,
done.
I don't even like tea. So for me, it was coffee. But there you go.
So. What is that feeling like when you get that first deployment? You said you went to Germany, you were stationed out there, but because that there must be two kind of feelings going on. You know, when you get your first deployment overseas, and then when you first go into a theatre, how do you kind of process that? Because it must be so many different emotions going on, you know, to really get through.
Yeah, I mean, actually, funnily enough, my first operational deployment was Northern Ireland, which, of course, you know, wasn't on tanks at all. I was then back to my, as I said before, everybody's trained as sort of the infantry role. So I was actually trudging the streets of Belfast, you know, with a rifle and reacting to that. So, but of course, many people say, but in essence, it's what you train for. I mean, I know it sounds almost harsh, but it's what you train. I mean, you know, everything is about training in the army. You are training and training and training. And of course, what you're training for is the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario is an operational deployment. So you're apprehensive, of course, but of course, you're also naturally a little bit excited because it's the job that you have prepared, you know, sometimes years for to do. Northern Ireland, of course, everybody, we were expecting it at some stage. I mean, but then, you know, later on in life when, you know, I was in the Gulf War, for example, you know, things like that come across, and that's probably when you're thinking, yeah, this is, you know, this was almost unexpected, of course, at that stage. And that's a bit more harsh, but yeah. I can't remember what your question was, Tim, to be honest. But
saying how you kind of felt, what was your emotions, being on operation?
Yeah, apprehensive, pensive, but excited as well, yeah.
And I suppose the other thing is, you know, talking about the aspect of going out on operational deployment is, you know, you have to be a very good, not a risk taker, but someone that can weigh up risks very well. And how much of that is down to your training in terms of, like, protocol and whatever, and how much of that is just kind of, you have to be, you know, assured of what you're doing and who you are as a person to go out and do that sort of stuff. Do you have a lot of guys that just kind of just can't hack it in that sense on operation deployment?
I think especially the tank crew, because a tank crew, probably unlike a lot of the army, you work very closely with a number of men. I mean, a tank crew in the British Army is four people. So you work inside this, you know, steel box all the time. And it's all about drill. So it's, in the army, you always say automatic reaction to a familiar fire order. Now, if somebody was to shout at me loaded straight away from my subconscious, I would think about the loading sequence for, you know, Challenger 2 tank or something. So it's all about, when you're doing that, I think to a degree, you don't actually almost think about what you're doing when you're reacting in a tank crew. And of course, the big thing about any part of the army is it's all about the man next to you. So you want to do the best possible job you possibly can to keep not only yourself safe, but also, and I think almost more importantly, the people that you're working with. So, you know, a good tank crew, you're all great at your jobs. You all know your job inside out, but more than anything else, you want to keep everybody safe. You want to do your job to the best of your ability and also support, obviously, the wider formation. So whether it's the troop or the, you know, brigade or whatever you're working at that particular time.
And I suppose that must be an amazing feeling, really, knowing that, you know, it's almost more than a job, isn't it? You know, if you left your job in the normal world, you probably wouldn't keep touch with any of these people that you've worked with. But I imagine in the army, it's such a different feeling. They're more like your family, aren't they? You're working with such close proximity and in such kind of high pressure situations that it becomes more than just kind of someone you work with, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've kept in touch with, you know, sort of close friends, you know, a dozen or so really close friends in the armed forces, you know, ever since we left, and we all went our separate ways into civilian street. But of, I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, don't forget, you're with these people, certainly when you're talking operational deployment, you're with them 24 hours a day. You're sometimes in a tank crew, you know, you're all sleeping together. That sounds awful, doesn't it? You're all sleeping together, you're eating together. And very much of the time, like anything in the armed forces, it's you know, it's dead boring when you're in Iraq and nothing's happening. It could be days sometimes of nothing happening. You're sitting around in a tank or something waiting for something to happen. So you get to know each other. You know each other's families. That you get stories about the children. We read each other letters from home. It's very, you know, very unlike, I think, probably how close you would get to anybody else. And even when you're not on operational deployment, you're training with these people back in, you know, your camp, wherever that may be. As a young single man, you're obviously going out and maybe having a bit too much to drink together and that as well. So, yeah, you do form a very tight bond with everybody.
I mean, touching on what you've just said about kind of reading letters from back home and stuff, work-life balance must be quite hard to find, because imagine, you know, if you've got a family and you are a single man out there on operational deployment, how is it, you know, how can you manage that relationship between your work and your family and everything like that, especially when you are overseas? Is it hard?
It is without any shadow of doubt fundamentally the hardest part about being in the armed forces, yeah. It's, I think, the main reason why most people leave in the end, because, as I said, it's, as a young man, it's, you have the excitement, you have the adrenaline, you have the desire. But as the years progressed, I mean, operational deployments now for the majority of our armed forces, the armed forces have decreased in size, therefore the operational deployments, unfortunately, haven't decreased in size. So they get more and more tours. You know, it's not unknown for some regiments to 6 months at home, 6 months on a tour, 6 months at home, 6 months on a tour. And when you've got a family, and especially young children, it's incredibly hard. It is, I would, without any shadow of doubt, say probably the hardest thing about doing the job as a career in the long term. And probably the reason ultimately why I decided, you know, enough is enough, it's time to go. I had a family, I wanted to see them more.
And what sort of stuff kind of kept you going when you were out on tour in that regard? And what did you like to receive from your family when you were out on operational deployment?
I think anything from home is fantastic. I mean, it really is. And, you know, I mean, the Gulf War was probably a trickiest one because we actually didn't have mail. We didn't have access to phones or anything as well because of all the secrecy and security as well. But we did. I mean, the general public are fantastic. I'll always remember, you always get sent a lot of, they were called care boxes from the general public with a letter from somebody you've never met and don't know. But it was really, really nice, very touching. Unfortunately, they used to put a lot of chocolate in there. And obviously, when it was like, you know, 90 degrees in the shade, the chocolate was pretty disgusting. But anything that breaks away from the monotony of doing a job like that, it was fantastic and a real treat. What we could have done with, I don't think I ever bought toothpaste for about 3 years after being in Iraq. We had that much toothpaste sent to us.
Set up your own reselling in a toothpaste market. That's fantastic. So if I could, what would you say is, you know, one of your big highlights from your time in the armed forces?
Oh, good
and
Lord.
That's a terrible question because you've got a lot.
It's, I suppose as your career progresses, because obviously I did a long time at the end of the day. And I had, the good thing about the army, of course, is you don't, it's not all doing the same thing. So throughout my time, you do your promotion courses, you do different courses in different parts. I was then very lucky when later on in my army career, I worked with the CGS's briefing team, the chief of the general staff, which at the time was General Sir Mike Jackson, who was a proper soldier, really respected by his peers. And that for me was a fascinating 2 years being attached to his team and working for him. Where we had the opportunity to go around and talk to every part of the armed forces. And we used to, it was like a lecture from him via us about what's good, what's bad in the army, what can we do to improve it. That was fascinating. As I mentioned earlier, I did recruiting for 3 to 4 years, which was unbelievably fun. I mean, I didn't think such a thing would be, you know, that interesting, but to be able to meet young people who are going through everything that you went through, you know, sort of 25, 28 years ago, explaining to them about the job, being very honest and putting the pros and cons ahead of them. And of course, I was doing it in Central London. I was actually the Sergeant Major for Central London. So of course, the variety of people that we had to get through, I probably can't name some of the stories actually, because they were quite close to the bone, but unbelievable. I do remember vividly, I had some young lady who came in one day, very, very good, had a really good educational background, wanted to join the military police. And obviously there are a lot of prerequisites for the armed forces as far as, you know, criminal records, health and fitness and that sort of thing. And then anyway, after about the second or third interview, she decided that she had to come clean with us, and she hadn't released it before, that she was actually had done time in jail for armed robbery. And this girl, I mean, I remember vividly sitting across from her at the desk, being absolutely, my jaw dropped to the floor, because it just wasn't what you would expect from this young woman. And then it turned out that the reason she wanted to join the armed forces was because she had a love of guns. And I thought, yeah, unfortunately, I think we'll have to stop the interview there. And that's probably, you're probably not quite suited to a life in the armed forces. So yeah, I think, and like you say before, operational deployments, fascinating, terrifying, exhilarating in many respects. And the people, I think at the end of the day, it was all the people I met along the journey. And I'm not just talking about people in the armed forces, but of course, again, I think what people tend to forget about the army is most of the time when you're in operational deployment, you are, you know, digging up perhaps landmines, you're building bridges, you're helping people get their lives back together, you're putting, you know, rebuilding a school as we were involved in Iraq. It's not all about the fighting side of it. There's a lot of humanitarian work that goes with it, which is incredibly rewarding from our perspective. And coupled with working with, you know, other armed forces from around the world, you know, from Americans, Australians, and every other nation that you could possibly think of, I think at one stage we probably worked with.
So essentially, you know, there's so much more to the army than just being in the infantry, isn't there? There's, you know, something for everyone, essentially.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, you mentioned earlier on about going in the RAF. I actually applied for the Army Air Corps whilst I was in the army to fly helicopters. And I managed to pass all the tests and everything, started the training. And you thought, where could, you know, this young lad have suddenly come, I'm mid-20s by now, and I'm training to be a helicopter pilot. But I have to say, it wasn't actually my cup of tea. I didn't enjoy the experience, but I thought I would love it. I just actually missed tanks. I missed armoured warfare and that side of it. So I did about 3 weeks. I did my fixed wing. So Chipmunk, I think it was, we were training at that particular stage. And I didn't get onto rotary, and I felt really sheepishly had to go into the office and say, I'm sorry, this is not really for me, and I want to go back into the tank regiment. So the opportunities are there to specialise, to completely, you can transfer units if you fancy becoming an engineer, that's possible. So the job variety is massive, is vast, really.
And to that degree, on the job training as well, you know, you can go from having no qualifications to having a PhD, being a professor in anything, can't you, through the military?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in recruiting, I mean, obviously the prerequisite for an officer in the armed forces is somewhat different. You have to do the Sandhurst, you have to have a degree to back you up, etc. But theoretically, you could go in with, you have to have a, you know, you obviously have to have the basic education, maths and English predominantly. But yeah, you can certainly, the opportunity to learn a trade, you could come out as, you know, a qualified plumber, bricklayer, mechanic. In fact, we always used to say, I think the only trade at one stage in the British Army that you couldn't do was a hairdresser. Everything else you could probably train, and I'm sure there was actually somewhere, but you could train to do most other things in there.
Isn't that listed the number one clipper all over?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Which I'm desperate for at the moment.
Hence why I'm wearing a hat, you'll see. So, yeah, I think it's amazing to hear all these stories and, you know, to show everyone, and hopefully everyone listening can realise that, you know, you can pretty much do whatever you want to do in civilian street or in the military. There's something for everyone, and, you know, if you're considering it, and speak to someone like Richard or your local recruitment office and see what's available. So let's just take a little step back for a second. We're going to move away from the serious questions, the questions that are clearly making Richard anxious, and let's move into Tim's Three Tips, the section of the show where we discuss a home takeaway that you can use in your own life. So Richard, you're clearly a man of the military. You've done this for a fair few years. There must be some little tidbits you can offer to the listeners that have rubbed off in your time for how to keep a routine or be more organized, you know, in their daily lives. So if you could give us three bits of advice to bring a little bit more law and order to the listeners' everyday life.
A bit of law and order. Yeah, I was thinking about this when you mentioned this at the start of this. So what would I say? So my life lesson is something which I think a life lesson, and it probably works well for the military to civilian, never volunteer for anything. That's certainly my number one tip that I've learned over the years, and even carried that on to civilian street. Organisation, I certainly as a young man was incredibly organised. It does help massively throughout life, I think, to be organised. Comparison, I hope my wife's not listening to what we're talking about at the moment. I actually am a bit of a, I love doing paperwork and things. I'm incredibly organised when it comes to paperwork. My other half is incredibly not organised. So luckily it's a relationship that works well. But I have found it does make life go so much better. And I think what I've learned most about my time, both in the army and civilian street, is never take things too seriously. And, you know, whatever happens, there will be, at some stage, light at the end of the tunnel. Is that all right for you, Tim? Will that
yeah,
suffice?
Yeah, I think that's, they're very good and wise words to live by. And, yeah, definitely don't volunteer one is one I've fallen foul of. It's a piece of advice my dad gave me when I was younger. I never listened to him because it's my dad and I didn't want to. But I've learned that the hard way that, make sure you get voluntold and not volunteer. Excellent. So let's go back to more on where you are. You've now done your first kind of real deployment in a tank regiment. We've taken all the way through to working in the Gulf. So how did you get into doing this instructing side of training others then onto how to use a tank?
So you, as I said, the armed force, you're always working towards promotion because, of course, promotion brings responsibility and ultimately brings a better paycheck at the end of the month, which, of course, is what most people want. So you work your way up through in the Royal Tank Regiment. You learn the other trades. So the trades of a tank, you've got the gunner, which I was qualified when I left my equivalence basic training. I was then a driver for a while, so driving a main battle tank, which I absolutely despised. It was not a thing for me. So you learn all about the engineering side of it, so the mechanics, fixing tanks, changing tracks and driving, et cetera, et cetera. You then usually there at that stage, after that, you become what's called a loader or an operator. Now, the loader or an operator on a tank is usually a minimum of a lance corporal, and that is, for all intents and purposes, the second in command of a tank. So the loader, as the name suggests, is the guy who loads the main armament. He also works the radios. And if something was to happen to the commander, he's the man who could step up and actually command the tank. And the pinnacle of any tank man's career is to do a commander's course. So the commander's course, it's a lengthy course, 6 months plus sometimes. And you do things like map reading, tactics. You also brush up on all the skills that everybody else in there. So the commander is ultimately in charge of that vehicle. He is at that stage fully qualified in everything. So he knows everybody else's job. And that is the best, by far the best part to be in there. Unfortunately, after commander, things start to go downhill a bit because then you tend to get promoted. And then ultimately you're usually taken off a tank and given something else. So, you may become like, I was very lucky to get a warrant officer. So you get put in, work with a squadron or something. And then all these other postings, we used to call them, come across. So gunnery was always my thing. I was always fascinated by gunnery. So I was sent off as a corporal at that stage to do a gunnery instructor's course. Depending on the grade you got on that particular course, was then you were recommended for what was called a schools instructor. And a schools instructor were the people that went away and taught the instructors. So they teach the teachers, if that makes sense. And also, when you become a schools instructor, you take other regiments, so not necessarily just your own, away on live firing exercises, and you're in charge of it. You have to work out safety templates and blah, blah, blah. So I was very fortunate. I went away and did my schools instructor's course and spent a really good 2 years, actually, down in Lulworth, which is south coast of England, as a schools instructor, which is a great, great thing to do. Say after that, then it tended to be, I got the CGS briefing job, which was fantastic. And then finally really finished up as in the training wing, which is when I got offers of other employment outside of the armed forces.
So that leads me quite nicely into my next question. What are some good ways to manage stressful situations, whether that is in a tank, in a war zone, or, in Whitehall when you're talking to all these bigwigs and whatever? How did you handle those situations?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I was always like the CGS, when you mentioned the CGS briefing team, it suddenly went from, and you're never actually taught this, funnily enough, you're suddenly there standing up in front of sometimes 1,000+ people in a regiment, lecturing or answering questions or something. And I don't think that in particular is anything you could really prepare for other than you just do it. But I think in the army, that is the mentality. Whereas perhaps elsewhere you would expect it to be trained for it. It's more a case of suck it and see. If you can do it, great. If you can't, it's not the end of the world. Let's just move on to the next thing. So that was, and dealing with, somebody like the CGS, I suppose it's probably very hard for somebody who hasn't been in the army to appreciate when you're working so closely like that. The man was the head of the armed forces. And not only the commanding officer, who's the head of your own regiment, which you treat as, somewhat royalty, but this was the man who would, have daily briefings with the prime minister and this sort of thing. You're suddenly working very closely with him. So I think one thing the army does do in spades, it teaches you to have a great outlook and humour about everything. And I think that comes across, certainly when you're speaking to people, that straight away you could tell that him as a prime example, he did have a wicked sense of humour. He was very dry, very sarcastic. And I thought, we are going to hit this off. And, you know, he used to call me all the names under the sun. And he had this, I always remember vividly, he had an armoured staff car to drive him to meetings occasionally. And I once borrowed it and actually pranged it in the middle of London. I drove into back of a car. So I remember vividly walking into, at that time, he was based in Whitehall, and he had this sort of office that went on forever, you know, the entrance to it, these great big oak double doors. And open these doors, and he just said, Sergeant Major, come in, sit down. This is a chat without a cup of tea or anything. And what have you done to my car? But he took it all fantastically. So I think a sense of humour was a must. And I don't think that's just in the armed forces. I think that's never take yourself too seriously, I think, was my motto.
I mean, yeah, again, very wise words. And yeah, I imagine you went out of that meeting with your tail between your legs.
Do
it again.
And I had to pay for it. It came out of my salary. So there you go.
Very good. So as you mentioned, getting towards the end of your military service, and you were thinking about finishing up, what did you kind of, what was your thought process to wanting to, you know, leave the military, and what was kind of going through your head? Because I imagine it is, you know, as you said, you didn't have any understanding of what council tax was or what the kind of the real world was. Mm. What were those emotions going through your head at that point? Because it must have been very daunting.
Yeah, because most people do, when you do a career in the armed forces, it's normally 22 years a career, then you actually retire. There is a thing called the Long Service List, LSL, where you get an opportunity for those that, you know, perhaps want it and are picked, that you can go on and do things like recruiting and blah, blah, blah. So theoretically, I think I probably had, I could, I think, probably have done until retirement date in the army. And I was happy. I was happy doing what I was doing. But there was always this desire, I thought, to do, you know what, I've done nearly 30 years doing this job. It's time for something else. And really, the opportunity with, you know, the gaming industry came out of the blue. I just literally received a phone call one day from a headhunter who said, look, I've been chatting with it's called the Royal Tank Regiment Association. It's sort of like, for want of a better word, like a welfare department within our regiment. And this gaming company are after somebody who's got operational experience on tanks, has, you know, served on tanks, knows a little bit about them. How do you fancy applying for the job? And going back to something we said earlier, at that stage, most of all, it was wanting to see more of my family in a bit more of a, I hate to say normal, because that's not the word I'm looking for, but if that makes sense, a more normal environment, but also wanting to see that, look, I do not want to become this person that has done this all my life. Eventually I will have to leave, and I'd rather be prepared to leave, if that makes sense. I'd had a taste in recruiting. I was living in my own flat at that stage. I was living more as a civilian than before. So I thought, you know what, I really want to give this a go, and I want to perhaps, you know, test myself to make sure I can do it. Because you do get, you know, as I said before, it's probably, I'm not saying the worst thing, because it's not, it does give you the stability, but obviously the flip side of that stability is perhaps the not being aware of life outside of this very, you know, regimented, organised environment, which has, you know, massive pros, but also cons as well, of course.
So what support is there really then for people coming out of the military in terms of assimilating back into, you know, civilian life and whatever, and, you know, what can, I think there's another good question is, what can employers do to help support, you know, and foster, you know, people from the military to come and join their businesses?
I think they do a lot of resettlement courses. So you would do, whether it's, I mean, for example, if you want to be, and I hate to use this example because it's what most people feel in the armed forces, they want to be, but like an HGV driver, they would get you an HGV qualification, blah, blah, blah. There's all manner of resettlement courses you can do. I think the problem I had at that particular stage was I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think that's very much where, of course, a resettlement course is great, and it gives you this, you know, I don't know how much an HGV license costs, but I'm sure it's a few thousand or something. So at least you've got that foothold. But what I think I really needed at that stage, and I think is a little bit lacking in the armed forces, is for somebody realistic to say, look, this is, the work environment is a harsh place. You know, it's, you know, you are going to be going up against, you know, 20, 30, 1,000 or more people for your particular job that you want to do. And also, I did feel as well that they tend to pigeonhole you into jobs, like things like a lot of people went to police force was a prime example. A lot of people leave the army and join the police force, which is great. I'm not, nothing wrong with it at all. Or they become drivers, or they do HGV, or if they were in the REME, the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, they tend to think that they've got to go and do something in that field. So you almost get pigeonholed into something. And I think what's anybody in the army needs to do is think there's a massive job space out there. There are jobs that you've probably never knew existed, which you're going to have the skills for. And again, don't sell yourself short, because again, I was like everybody else leaving after a long career in the army thinking, you know, I'm older. I haven't got the qualifications of some of these people. I'm not as experienced. It was all about experience in a job. You know, what have I got to offer? So open up yourself to opportunities, which is obviously is what happened to me dramatically. And also for people that are taking on, I mean, the things, I suppose the pros about anybody that was in the army, you are pretty damn organized. You're very hardworking amongst all else. You're very used to long hours, you know, and sociable hours. And really, I mean, I always remember when I went to this job that I'm doing now, you know, they the bonus. And I was like, what is a bonus? I've never heard of a bonus in my life. I thought all my Christmases have come at once. It wasn't something I was aware of. A bonus, you know, we got a bonus in the army. So again, yeah, really open yourself up. And for, you know, potential people out there looking for, you know, please don't write off anybody who served in the army, because they're hardworking, they're dedicated. And, you know, we always strive to do the best we could.
So to a certain extent, when you leave the army, is it almost like going back to that feeling of when you're 16 and you have no idea what you want to do with your life in terms of a job and stuff? And
yeah, and I do think as well, it depends very much on the rank in the army. I've got a lot of officers who were friends, and when I say, you know, at their stage of leaving perhaps the army, they were commanding officers, they were in charge of, you know, 1,000+ men at one particular stage in their lives. And I also think that sometimes they, you know, they don't do themselves any favours, because you cannot expect to go from that level to an equivalent level, or even some of them obviously want to go to a higher level in civilian street. You haven't got the experience that they're looking for. Yes, you are fantastic when it comes to managing people, but it's very different to managing somebody in a workplace as opposed to, let's face it, I mean, the army, you tell somebody to do something,
they can say no in the real world, can't they?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you have all these, you know, issues to deal with. So, you know, be realistic about what your aspirations are, but don't expect to carry your rank that you had in the army into the workplace. It just will not work, and, you know.
So let's talk a bit about wargaming. What's that all about? What are you doing there for them?
So yeah, I got this phone call about this job, and I actually went, I thought, yeah, why not? I talked to my other half and she said, well, you know, go for an interview. So I went across to, at the time actually it was Paris. So I flew across to Paris, well, they flew me across to Paris of all places, which is worst places to have a job interview. I sat down with, at the time, the general manager and one of the directors, and they said, so Richard, tell us a bit about your life and your career and blah, blah, blah. So I did all that, and they said, well, do you know anything about the company? And obviously I'd done my homework and read a bit, but, you know, no more than Wikipedia or anything. So, you know, are you a gamer? And I was like, to be totally honest, no more than perhaps a bit of FIFA with my son or something, but a little more than that. And have you ever heard of World of Tanks, which, you know, at the time and still is one of the biggest games that they publish? And I was like, no, I'll be honest, I've played a few games now, of course, because I was coming for this. So I thought, this is an interview that's not going particularly well. And then we spoke about sort of life in general and everything else that I did in the army, and said, this is what we're looking for. And then I came back for, you know, and spoke to the family and said, look, this is what they've offered. There were big changes. It meant we'd have to relocate to Paris with the family. Is it something we really want to do? And again, I think at that stage it was, do you know what? I was receiving a pension anyway. You get an immediate pension after 22 years from the armed forces. Let's try it. Let's see. And what's the worst that can happen? We're going to live in Paris for a while, not enjoy the job, not enjoy the place perhaps, and decide that that's it. You know, let's do a little else. So we gambled. We gambled on it and did it, yeah.
So what does your role now entail? And What sort of stuff are you getting up to, if you can share it with us?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's hard to explain, actually, because it's got this odd title of Head of Military Relations for Europe. It's really bizarre. So it tends to be, because the wargaming world of world is all about historical games. So we've got World of Tanks, World of Warships, and World of Warplanes. The game I actually work on and part of the product group for is World of Tanks. And it's my job is that, in the initial time of the company, it was a lot of research and development side of things. So in my particular game, there are a lot of armored vehicles, a lot of tanks, sort of like, you know, Second World War-esque vehicles. So I would actually enable the research and development for the developers to get the information about these tanks. This then manifested itself to, we do a lot of marketing and PR now with museums around the world, with we actually work with, funnily enough, the Royal Tank Regiment on certain things. We're just begin work with the French Foreign Legion. So again, a lot of marketing, a lot of PR. We do a lot of content. So our audience absolutely love the historical side of the game. So we do content to do that. So whether it's talking about particular armored vehicles or tanks. So it's an incredibly hard job to explain in a nutshell, but basically anything that may link to any part of the military that you want somebody to talk to, whether it's for the marketing side of it, I tend to be the one that gets thrown in there and does the negotiations and all the rest of it.
And I imagine you use a lot of your contacts that you already have and have subsequently made to get that information. And
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, the great part, the part is probably the reason why I took the job in the first place, was because having, I met with the CEO, a chap called Victor Kisley, who was the creator, founder of the World Tanks. And his passion for history was, you know, absolutely apparent. It was all about history, history, history. And we do so much. We've sponsored over the years, we've sponsored restorations on vehicles. We work with a lot of tank museums around the world. We support veterans funds. We do a lot of fundraising. Our particular charity is War Child, if you're aware of them. So it's that side of it. And for me, I'm so passionate about history, but more so, probably equally so, the people that actually did so much for us during that period. So be able to give back a little through my job was absolutely fantastic. So my other half said, I'm probably going to go to my grave talking about tanks or something, because it has seemed to have been the biggest part of my life.
And there's a lot of synergy, isn't it? They always say that, you know, gamers make good military men and women, don't they? And do you think that that's true? Do you think that people that play a lot of games and you know, can serve in the armed forces and whatever and be good members of the military, and or is that just kind of blowing smoke up of someone's bum?
No, I'm not at all. I mean, especially now we're talking, you know, the likes of Challenger 2 with the simulation and everything. I mean, you know, it is a fact that, you know, the joysticks are very similar that you use for gaming as you do to armored vehicles, some armored vehicles, of course. Dexterity for any tank crew is all about dexterity, and obviously gamers' dexterity, well, the good gamers, should I hasten to add, is in spades, isn't it? So, yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And I always found that the early days in particular, the biggest part of my job was, we've got a very passionate community in World of Tanks. It would always be about, like, the questions everybody asks, you know, what was it like? What's it like being in a tank? Blah, 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 blah. So you sort of almost become a sort of spokesperson for people who are interested in probably, you know, perhaps going into a career in the armed forces. Unfortunately, I was in the position and am now where I can be 100% honest about what to expect, as opposed to, obviously, you know, somebody who's being paid to recruit or whatever, whereas, you know, say maybe this is not a thing for you, or there, this is what I loved about it, this is what I didn't like about it.
And I suppose you're a good first filter as well, in case there's any of those fanatics who are maybe crossing the line between
interest and... Yeah, why do you want to join the army?
Yeah. And there we go. If we could just do a bit of self-reflection, I've got kind of two questions that I'd love to ask you. So, firstly, what is that one piece of advice you'd wish someone had given you as a young man before you started your career in the military?
Good question. One piece of advice. I think I probably mentioned it before, really, is don't take yourself too seriously. And I think I was probably guilty of that, certainly during, you know, when you talk about promotion. It's a very regimented organization, as you can imagine. So And don't burn your bridges, of course, because everybody who serves in the army, regardless of rank or position you were holding then, has to go back to, you know, the drawing board, so to speak, when they return to civilian life. So, you know, value the friendships, but never treat people as you would like to treat yourself. How does that sound?
Very Christian of you. So finally, I know you said that you want to be remembered for talk about tanks, or at least your other half has said that, but how would you like to be remembered when you depart this dear earth in terms of your mark you can have left on the planet?
Well, good question. I think for me, as a family, you know, a big family man, I've got quite a large family. I think I'd just like to be remembered as a great dad. That was all. I don't want anything else.
I think that's perfectly acceptable. Yeah. That's perfectly acceptable. And as I say, every time I do this episode, you know, your career journey is very personal to each and every one out there. And so you can't compare your goals, your aspirations, or even the timeline of how it goes, and just kind of buckle up and stay in for the ride.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, obviously, as a young man, everybody wants to be wealthy, don't they, at the end of the day? Let's face it, if we're all honest to ourselves, you want to do well. I mean, but I think, you know, there's such a lot more than, yes, I'm not denying that money is great and it buys you a nice house and the car and keeps your family safe and warm and fed. But at the end of the day, you've got to be in a job where you are, I'm not saying looking forward to getting up every morning, because I'm not sure such a job exists, but at least looking forward to getting up most mornings.
Richard, it's been absolutely fantastic to chat to you. I've been looking forward to this one for a while. Where can the listeners find out more about, you know, World of Tanks or yourself or any of that kind of stuff? I imagine they can just Google it.
Yeah, I mean, Google my name, or it's there's a Facebook page, there's Twitter and all the rest of it. Or if you search for World of Tanks, you can see the game or anything. And I won't mention our podcast, Tim, because that would be cruel. So,
Of course. No, plug away.
So we've also done a podcast called Tank Nuts. So just Google that as well, where I get the opportunity to sit in your seat and talk to people from the sort of historical world, collectors, ex-veterans, that sort of thing as well. So.
Well, I'll definitely give that a listen as well, because, I'm very big into my military history as well. So, I'll give that a listen and drop the info in the show notes as well for anyone else that's interested. But yes, thank you again so much for coming on and putting up with my slightly odd questions sometimes. I hope you have a fantastic rest of the year. I'm trying to, do you know what? This is the first episode I've avoided mentioning COVID for the whole episode. So I feel like this is the first one that will be timeless for whenever it gets released. So I pat myself on the back for that. But thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Tim. Thanks ever so much for having me.
My thanks go to Richard Cutland for coming on the show and speaking so honestly about his experiences. As he mentioned, if you want to listen to his podcast all about military history and tanks, just search for Tank Nuts on your podcast platform of choice. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing to the show and checking out some of the other episodes and hear all about some of our other fantastic guests. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts by scrolling to the bottom of the Job Hunter podcast page and tapping on Write a Review. This literally takes 30 seconds and helps us increase our reach by offering honest feedback on what our listeners think about our show. You can follow us on all our socials, just search at Job Hunter Pod or Job Hunter Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Or if you'd like to get in touch, drop us an email. It's jobhunterpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening this week. Tune in next time for another exciting episode of the Job Hunter Podcast.